happy birthday today to Norma Jean Block of Humboldt, to Ruth McLaren of Sioux City, to Russ Munson of Carroll, and to Shelley Zittrich of Humboldt. Happy birthday to all of you. You're joined today by that great smooth voice of Smokey Robinson, who turns 84 today, and actor Jeff Daniels, who turns 69. So a happy birthday to everybody who celebrates February 19 as their birthday. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television or Iowa PBS and are not a registered IRIS user, please let us know. Give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. Now, here's Nicole with today's only obituary.
And today we would like to remember David H. Rabinowitz of Kansas City. David Hertz Rabinowitz was 72 years old of Kansas City, passed away peacefully on Thursday, February 15th. Funeral services will be taking place in his hometown of Des Moines, Iowa at 1:30 p.m. on Monday, February 19th. That is today. His funeral is happening this afternoon at 1:30. For those who can't attend the ceremony in person, the services will be live-streamed, which can be accessed at his obituary page at www.illiscares.com. His services will be at the Jewish Glendale Cemetery. Memorial contributions in honor of David can be made to the Kehilleth Israel Synagogue in Kansas City, the Bureau of Jewish Education in Phoenix, Arizona, or the Sunflower Bakery in Washington, D.C. David was born May 15, 1951, to the late Ronald and Rosa Rabinowitz of Des Moines, Iowa. He graduated from Roosevelt High School and attended the University of Iowa, receiving his bachelor's in recreational management. David started his career with JCC's in El Paso and Houston, Texas. He then moved over to Kansas City, where he directed the Barney Goodman Summer Camp. David later started working in the restaurant business. He opened his first restaurant, The Metropolis, with Steve Schick, which served the Westport high-end dining community from the 1980s to the 90s. Before his retirement, David served as restaurant manager at the Hotel Rafael on the Plaza. David loved his family and friends, vintage cars from the 40s and 50s, and of course, the Kansas City Chiefs. He was a member of the Kehilleth Israel Synagogue, where he spent many Shabbat gatherings in high school with SYO friends. David and family in Mexico enjoyed Mexican food and culture, even honoring his conversational Spanish by watching Telemundo. David will be remembered as a sweet guy with a kind and gentle soul. He is survived by three sisters, Dina of Chevy Chase, Maryland, Myra of Scottsdale, Arizona, and Judy Rabinowitz of Des Moines. You can leave online condolences for the family at www.lewismemorialchapel.com or at www.illiscares.com.
And we're returning now to the news stories. Big tech pledges a crackdown on deep fakes. Under pressure from the White House and governments around the globe, major technology companies pledged Friday to crack down on artificial intelligence-generated deep fakes that could undermine the integrity of major elections in the U.S. and overseas this year. Google, Meta, TikTok, and other companies said that they would join forces to create tools to detect and debunk electronic deep fakes in the election. They unveiled the Accord as political and security leaders gathered at the Munich Security Conference in Germany. The deep fakes in question are videos, images, and audio that alter or fake the appearance, voice, or actions of political candidates, election officials, or other key figures in an election. These alterations can also be used to mislead voters about when, where, and how to vote. The coalition that includes Adobe, Amazon, Microsoft, OpenAI, and X, formerly Twitter, promised to be open with the public about how it combats AI-generated falsehoods that attempt to disrupt elections on their platforms. But battling bad actors will require what is called a whole-of-society response, the company said. Virtually anyone can now create or digitally alter images and clips in realistic ways to target or deceive voters. We are committed to doing our part as technology companies while acknowledging that the deceptive use of AI is not only a technical challenge, but a political, social, and ethical issue, and hope that others will similarly commit to action across society, they said. The accord is similar to a voluntary pledge made of the same companies signed in July after a meeting at the White House. This is an important step toward good platform hygiene and a better internet, but there is substantially more to do, says Josh Lawson, director of AI and democracy at the nonprofit think tank Aspen Institute. This has to be a floor, not a ceiling, for future work, he said. This year, we'll set a record for the largest number of people living in countries holding nationwide elections, including India and Mexico, raising concerns that AI will play a role at the ballot box. With rapid advances in technology and little oversight from the government, election experts are bracing for the malicious use of deepfakes in this year's U.S. presidential contest. During New Hampshire's primary election last month, AI-generated robocalls mimicking President Joe Biden's voice tried to discourage people from voting. Biden signed an executive order on AI in October, but AI technologies are advancing so quickly that lawmakers and regulators are having trouble keeping up. With few rules governing AI-generated content in the U.S., the European Union has taken the lead. It requires that companies identify and label deepfakes. It is good that many of the large tech platforms have agreed to identify and label deepfakes, but their action falls short of what is needed, said Daryl West, a senior fellow at the Center for Technology Innovation at the think tank Brookings Institution. We already are seeing fake videos and audio tapes, and that usage is likely to grow as we get closer to the election, he said. Critics say tech companies cannot be trusted to regulate themselves, and more needs to be done to hold the companies and their platforms accountable for content that aims to trick voters. This is a feeble response on the part of the tech companies, given the risk we are already seeing in the form of political disinformation and election interference, Haney Farid, a University of California, Berkeley professor who specializes in deepfakes and disinformation, said in an email. Moreover, the agreement does not apply to other online platforms that are notorious for spreading election-related lies, Farid said. There are many bad players in this space who are not being invited into the White House for a photo op, and these players are not going to comply with voluntary standards, Farid said. The quality of deepfakes has rapidly improved, making them harder to distinguish from authentic videos, images, and audio. The worry is that voters might not be able to tell the difference between what is real and what is AI, and that could lead people to question authentic content as well. Lawson, who previously worked on election integrity and platform policies at Facebook owner Meta, expects AI-generated election misinformation and persuasion content will pop up in places where people do not expect it, such as individual SMS messages or WhatsApp channels. These messages can deceive voters about polling places or target specific language communities to suppress voter turnout. There is no federal law banning deep fakes. While creating a deep fake to swing the outcome of an election may seem deeply unethical, it is currently legal in most places in the United States, and we should assume that as long as it's legal, it's a huge risk, said Ilana Beller, organizing manager for the Public Citizen Democracy Campaign. Some executive agencies have stepped in to fill the policy gaps. The Federal Election Commission is considering rule changes that would ban federal candidates from using generative AI tools to misrepresent their political rivals. The Federal Communications Commission this month banned the use of AI-generated voices in robocalls. The ban came 2 days after the FCC issued a cease and desist order against the company responsible for the audio deep fakes of Biden's voice in New Hampshire. The Federal Trade Commission this week moved to adopt new rules around impersonation, citing the threat of AI-generated scams. A handful of states, Michigan, Minnesota, California, Washington, and Texas, already have laws in place to restrict AI in political communications. During this legislative session, lawmakers in 32 states have introduced 52 bills to regulate deepfakes in elections, according to Public Citizen. Some of the state bans include, some of the state bills ban AI-generated content in political ads or require disclaimers on AI-generated content. Other deepfakes banned. Let me read this paragraph again because I really messed it up. Some of the state bills ban AI-generated content in political ads or require disclaimers on AI-generated content. Others ban deepfakes before an election.
And this next article is from the online version of the Des Moines Register. Who took $105,000 from security expert's Iowa account? Months later, he still doesn't know. This is from Tyler Jett of the Des Moines Register. Sam Decay was enjoying a calm fall morning in his Manhattan apartment, when an email came through. First Whitney Bank and Trust in his hometown of Atlantic, Iowa, informed him that $9,950 had been debited from his account. "Thank you for your business," read that email that sent at 8:29 a.m. on October 10th. But Decay, 75 years old, says that he had not made any payments or cut any checks from that account, which he inherited from his mother when she died in February of 2023. Confused, Decay called the bank, where employees pulled up a scan of the cashier's check that had been deposited by an April McGilvra. The check had Decay's account number at the bottom, and at the top, it read Whitney Bank and Trust, an incorrect name for the bank. Decay says that the employee told him that someone must have committed fraud. It was the beginning of a mystery that points to what experts say is a growing problem. More messages, more missing money, and more questions. So the next morning, Decay received two more emails from the bank. The first one told him at 8:39 a.m. that his account had been debited $50,500. Another thank you for your business email came at the same time, informing him that he was out another $42,250. Scans of two more checks deposited by someone identified as Alan Cortez looked almost identical to the first one, with the same incorrect name for the bank. Decay says that First Whitney had replaced the $105,000 that he lost, but still, 4 months later, the case perplexes him. Of all people, Decay had a similar interest in crimes like these. He spent his career protecting companies from fraud, retiring as Vice President of Information Security at the BNY Mellon International Investment Firm. He says it becomes more of a detective story, more of a forensic tale. Decay's story is not one of a victim taking justice into his own hands, tapping his decades of experience to track a criminal and extracting revenge. But rather, Decay reported the fraud to the Iowa Division of Banking. He says the First Whitney employees told him that they would also investigate this case. From his apartment overlooking the Hudson River, he recently told the Des Moines Register he doesn't know what came of this case. The Division of Banking has not contacted him since October, and a spokesperson for that agency told the Register that the state laws ban employees from publicly disclosing details of investigations. First Whitney CEO Paul Good likewise declined to comment on the details of Decay's case. He said in an email, "Our staff continues to try and educate our customers, and we have been able to stop a wide range of scams, from phishing to bogus phone calls that seeks personal information. The thieves are innovative." Spokespeople at the Atlantic Police Department, the Cass County Sheriff's Office, and also the Cass County Attorney's Office said they had not received a report of check fraud at First Whitney. Asked why he didn't report the case to law enforcement there, Decay says the issue seems too technical for the Atlantic Police. From his career in banking, Decay says, he was surprised by the nature of this crime. He has long contemplated cyber attacks, with hackers extracting hundreds of thousands of dollars without fingerprints. He says this was an old-fashioned sort of fraud. But the old-fashioned is back in vogue, banking experts say. Check fraud cases more than doubled in the state from 2020 to 2023. This is according to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. It's a division of U.S. Treasury. Banks across the country have also experienced a similar trend. Banking and criminal justice officials say they aren't quite sure why check fraud became more frequent since the pandemic. But Julie Gila, Vice President of Regulatory Compliance at the Iowa Bankers Association, says that criminals returned their focus to checks after companies and regulators took steps to protect debit and credit card transactions. If they can just get just a few checks through the system, they most likely can make a lot more money than several smaller debit card transactions. Fraudsters wash, cook checks, use mules and walkers to carry out fraud. There's actually a helpful thing here to look for elements of a fake check in a graphic. So you should look for, is the company name or address misspelled? Is the check stock flimsy or suspicious? Does the check number match the check number included in a line at the bottom of the check? You should also look for if the check have the correct routing number at the bottom for the bank that it's supposedly drawn on. And also, is the check missing the special ink for the MICR code at the bottom? So those are some things that you can look for or check for to see if you have a fake check or not. Paul Benda, the Vice President of Risk, Fraud, and Cybersecurity at the American Bankers Association, told a Senate committee on February 1st that criminals are stealing checks from the U.S. Postal Service. He said that fraudsters have stolen master keys and taken several people's mail in bulk, some even assaulted mail carriers. Benda says the mail system isn't nearly as secure as we thought. Postal Inspection spokesperson Michael Mark told the New York Times in March that the Postal Service is trying to make its blue mailboxes more secure. Among other fixes, the department will be adding rakes with metal teeth to prevent thieves from reaching into the boxes. Mike Burke, a senior robbery and crisis management consultant at a Waukee-based payment processor, Shazam, says that encrypted messages like the Telegram have helped criminals organize wide-scale check fraud. He said that fraudsters wash checks by using chemicals like nail polish remover to strip away pen ink. They then can write a new dollar amount in payee. Alternatively, some fraudsters also do cook checks by designing them online and then printing them check cardstock that they obtain from other countries. And once they have the checks, criminals can then seek money mules or walkers in online forums. They are willing to cash the check at banks, often with fake IDs. Burke says it has exploded. I've been in the game for 30 years, and this is the worst I've seen of it. Thus far, Decay says that he has been unsatisfied with First Whitney's response to his case. He says that employees have declined to explain how somebody could have received fake cashier checks with his bank account number on them. They don't want to talk about it, he says. They really don't. The discussion always will suddenly turn into, well, we think maybe a hacker has gained access to your computer, or I think you ought to change your password. It always comes back to Decay and his wife as if we're somehow responsible. He added that the struggles to understand how the problem could have occurred because of his online password. Before he retired, he says that he helped BNY Mellon write policies on how employees could protect the company from hackers, authoring rules about password requirements, encryption, wireless communication, and also how employees should handle printed banking material. First Whitney may also not know how the fraud occurred. David Karras, the CEO of Community Bankers of Iowa, a trade group, says that small banks struggle to get information when criminals deposit checks at larger institutions. He says the smaller community banks tend to work harder to try and catch criminals to find out how fraud occurred and also to stop it than a lot of the big national banks do. Big banks kind of just budget for it. Decay says that his inheritance of First Whitney account followed the death of his mother, Elizabeth, in February of last year. He planned to transfer the funds to another account, but he hasn't gotten around to it by last fall. The bank then closed his account and gave him a new one after the fraud. At the start of February this year, he says, a First Whitney employee called him to say that the bank detected another fraud attempt. But this time, he said, somebody tried to wire money out of his account. He said the bank did catch it, shut down his account, and once again gave him a new one, his third account in 4 months. So the most important part of the story is how to not fall victim to a check fraud. Sarah Grano, a spokesperson for the American Banking Association, has this information about check fraud and how to avoid it. What is check fraud? Well, this story has gotten way too long, so I'm just going to skip on how you can protect yourself. So first of all, you can consider making payments using e-check, ACH automatic payments, and other electronic and other mobile payments. You can also use pens with indelible black ink, so it's more difficult to wash your checks. Follow up with charities and other businesses to make sure they got your check. Use online banking to review copies of your checks to make sure they were not altered. If you receive paid checks back from the bank, shred, don't just trash them. Regularly review your bank activity and statements for errors, and don't leave blank spaces in your payee or amount lines for the checks you write. The U.S. Postal Inspection Services also has advice for you. Drop off mail in blue collection boxes before the last scheduled pickup time or directly inside your local post office. Regularly check your mail and don't leave your mail in your mailbox overnight. If you're headed out of town, have the post office hold your mail or ask a trusted friend or neighbor to pick up your mail. If you do fall victim, the Postal Inspection Service, you can report it at 1-877-876-2455. 1-877-876-2455. You can also report it to your local police department or your financial institution.
Well, that's a lot to think about, isn't it? Thanks for that. Well, the World Health Organization says that a Gaza hospital is no longer functional. Nasser Hospital near Khan Yunis, the largest functioning medical facility in Gaza before the Israeli raid last week, is now out of commission, the World Health Organization said on Sunday. Nasser Hospital in Gaza is not functional anymore after a week-long siege followed by the ongoing raid, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said in a social media post. Tedros said WHO teams bringing fuel were twice denied entry into the hospital as they sought to assess the condition of patients and medical needs. He added there are about 200 patients left in the hospital and at least 20 are in urgent need of referrals elsewhere. Khan Yunis in southern Gaza has been the focus of the Israeli offensive for weeks as a Hamas hub. The Israeli military said it arrested more than 100 militants, including 20 who participated in the October 7 attacks that triggered the Hamas-Israel war, in an incursion that began Thursday to seek the remains of hostages. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry said 70 medical personnel were among those arrested, leaving only 4 to care for patients, and that patients in hospital beds were also detained. 11 patients died because of the loss of power and oxygen caused by the sweep, the BBC reported. Tedros warned of more fatalities if those with critical needs do not get proper care. The cost of delays will be paid by patients' lives, he said. The October 7 attack on southern Israel killed about 1,200 people, mostly civilians. Around 250 hostages were taken, and militants still hold around 130, a fourth of them believed to be dead. Most of the others were released during a week-long ceasefire in November. The war has killed at least 28,985 Palestinians, mostly women and children, according to the health ministry, which does not distinguish between civilians and combatants in its records. On Sunday, it said 127 bodies were brought to hospitals in the past 24 hours. At least 18 people in Gaza were killed by Israeli strikes overnight into Sunday, among them 6 in the southern city of Rafah, including a woman and 3 children, and 7 in Gaza City in the north. In the central Gaza town of Zawadi, people dug through rubble from a Saturday airstrike to search for bodies, including those of children. Our message is to the Israeli government and the Hamas government present in Gaza, please stop the war. Enough war, said Samah Al-Karns, who lives near the building hit by the strike. In the occupied West Bank, a shootout erupted when Israeli forces went to arrest an armed suspect in the town of Tukaram. The military said the suspect was killed and a member of Israel's paramilitary border police was severely wounded. It described the target of the raid as a senior militant. The Palestinian Health Ministry said 2 Palestinians were killed. Meanwhile, U.S. Central Command said it struck 5 Houthi targets Saturday, including 3 anti-ship cruise missiles, a submarine drone, and a sea drone, after concluding, they said, they presented This is a quote from the U.S. military command, that the military command concluded that these three targets presented an imminent threat to the U.S. Navy ships and merchant vessels in the region. The U.S. said it would once again veto a draft U.N. Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, saying it goes against the efforts to find a permanent solution in the Israeli-Hamas conflict. The draft will not be adopted, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield said, referring to the motion circulated by Algeria, the Arab representative on the Security Council. It is critical that other parties give this process the best odds of succeeding, rather than push measures that put in and the opportunity for the enduring resolution of hostilities in jeopardy, she said. The U.S., Qatar, and Egypt have been trying for weeks to broker a ceasefire that would free the remaining hostages in Gaza, but they have faced unyielding demands by both Israel and Hamas. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called Hamas demands delusional. Netanyahu also opposes Palestinian statehood, which the U.S. calls a key element in a broader vision for the normalization of relations between Israel and regional heavyweight Saudi Arabia. On Sunday, the Israeli cabinet adopted a declaration saying the country, quote, categorically rejects international edicts on a permanent arrangement with the Palestinians, end quote, and opposes any unilateral recognition of the Palestinian state. The United Nations highest court opens historic hearings on Monday into the legality of Israel's 57-year occupation of land sought for a Palestinian state, plunging the 15 international judges back into the heart of the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict. 6 days of hearings are scheduled at the International Court of Justice, during which an unprecedented number of countries will participate as Israel continues its devastating assault on Gaza. Though the case occurs against the backdrop of the Israeli-Hamas war, it focuses instead on Israel's open-ended occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Palestinian representatives who speak first on Monday will argue that the Israeli occupation is illegal because it has violated three key tenets of international law, the Palestinian legal team told reporters Wednesday. They say that Israel has violated the prohibition on territorial conquest by annexing large swaths of occupied land, it has violated the Palestinians' right to self-determination, and has imposed a system of racial discrimination and apartheid. We want to hear new words from the court, said Omar Awadalla, the head of the UN organization's department in the Palestinian Foreign Ministry. They've had to consider the word genocide in the South African case, he said, referring to a separate case before the court, and now we want them to consider apartheid, he said.
And we're almost nearing the end of our broadcast. We're going to continue on with our 50 states in the Midwest states. Picking up in Detroit, Michigan. No, I already read that earlier. I crossed it out. Okay. Columbia, Missouri is the next city that I have not gotten to. Proven University of Missouri, training to help teachers with disruptive students in their classrooms, rolls out to more than 1,000 more teachers and administrators over the next 5 years due to an $8 million federal grant. The training so far has been used to help teachers of fifth grade math and science. In Lincoln, Nebraska, Nebraska voters will decide in November if the controversial Opportunities Scholarship Act involving state money and donations to private schools will stay or go. It's an issue proving to be confusing, complicated, and cantankerous. To Bismarck, North Dakota, a longtime public utilities regulator announced her candidacy for North Dakota's lone U.S. House seat. In Columbus, Ohio, the director of the state teacher's retirement system will remain on paid leave through mid-May and will be given professional development in the meantime. To Edmond, Oklahoma, a dream of transforming a former pasture on Edmond's east side into a showplace for outdoor art hasn't been corralled just yet. Discussions are underway between Edmond's Fine Arts Institute and city officials to see if a sizable chunk of 62 acres that's known as the Valley del Cavallo or Valley of the Horse could be the nonprofit's new home. Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Officials with the Sioux Falls Police Department have arrested 8 participants that they say are connected to an outdoor street racing event from October, charging them with $1,000 cash bond amount, as announced in a media briefing. Finally, in Rib Mountain, Wisconsin, standard wisdom would not encourage someone older than 80 years old to take up alpine ski racing. Mary Beth Kusher did not get that message. An unconventional thinker and an extraordinary athlete, the 85-year-old Antigua woman won a U.S. Ski and Snowboard National Masters Super G race this month that was held at the Granite Peak Ski Area in Rib Mountain. The only competitor in the women's 85 to 89 age group, she cruised down that course just a hair faster than 3 minutes and 10 seconds. That is a great way to end our broadcast today.
I'd say so. That makes me wonder if I've lived a wasted life, if she's skiing, taking up skiing at 85. Well, that brings the end to our shift. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Nicole Tam and me, Twyla Glenn. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. We'll continue now with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. With today's first opinion piece, here's Carol.
Thank you, Jeff. The headline says, Gaza is starving and a ceasefire is needed to save Palestinians. And there are several different people who authored this. Sean Callahan, Jan Eglin, Jada O'Doyen McKenna, Jeremy Kondike, Abby Maxim, Michelle Nunn, Janti Sirupto, and Charles Auba. And here's what they have to say. President Joe Biden recently said that in Gaza, there are a lot of innocent people who are starving. In fact, letting people in Gaza suffer and die from hunger and preventable disease is a political choice. If it's not too late to change this story, oh, that says it is not too late to change this story if urgent actions are taken to achieve a ceasefire and the release of the hostages and to allow a sufficient flow of aid into Gaza. Only an immediate stop to the fighting, a massive increase in humanitarian assistance, and the return of basic services can keep the number of deaths caused by hunger and disease from eclipsing the already shocking numbers of those killed in the war to date. 4 months after Israel launched its bombing campaign and tightened the siege of Gaza following Hamas's brutal October 7th attacks, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians now risk dying from hunger and preventable diseases. A further offensive on Rafah will surely accelerate the deepening hunger crisis, given the more than 1 million people sheltering there with nowhere safe left to go. It also will dramatically diminish the already weak flows of aid. When we reach our humanitarian colleagues in Gaza, they report the horrors of daily life. Parents going without food for days, telling hungry children there's nothing to eat, standing in line for full days to get a little wheat. One colleague writes, "If the situation continues, we will see one of the biggest disasters we have faced as humanitarians. It will be due to hunger, disease, and the very polluted and dangerous environment in Gaza, resulting from the residuals of the thousands of bombs, the white phosphorus, the raw sewage floating all over the place, and the unsafe water being consumed as people don't have other choices. The death toll approaches 30,000. 4 months of bombardment has killed almost 28,500 people, destroyed much of Gaza's housing, and eviscerated critical service infrastructure. The Integrated Food Security Phase classification, the global authority that monitors food insecurity and acute malnutrition, reports that the entire population of Gaza, more than 2 million people, is experiencing hunger at crisis levels or worse. There is a risk of famine, and it is increasing each day that the current situation of intense hostilities and restricted humanitarian access persists or worsens. This is the highest share of people facing high levels of acute food insecurity that the IPC initiative has ever classified for any given area or country. The suspension of funding for the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency by the U.S. government and other nations because of allegations that agency employees were involved in Hamas's attack exacerbates the nightmares and the risks. UNRWA, I suppose it could be pronounced UNRWA, provides life-saving services to more than three-quarters of the people in Gaza and logistical infrastructure on which most other aid depends. The speed of the deterioration in Gaza is unprecedented in recent history. Nearly 3 in 4 Palestinians in Gaza are drinking from contaminated water sources. Communicable diseases are on the rise. A reported 1.7 million people are displaced. Many are sheltering in UNRWA facilities. Almost half the population of Gaza is now in Rafah, facing more bombings and threatening invasion with nowhere else to go. Gaza is a small territory dependent for food on commercial imports. Its limited agricultural production has been completely derailed. Nearly all bakeries have closed due to lack of fuel and damage from airstrikes. Israel's siege has closed almost all border crossings and effectively halted commercial food imports. Even with 2 border crossings open, the amount of food being allowed is, in the words of a colleague, a drop of water to meet an ocean of need. Death sentences. We know all too well from experience what happens next. Prolonged hunger becomes acute malnutrition because aid is blocked. Vulnerable people lack adequate shelter and clean water. Basic health care and nutrition services are unavailable. And large-scale death follows. Most who die in a famine are actually killed by disease rather than starvation, their bodies so weakened that routine infections become death sentences. Gaza no longer has medical services to mitigate these risks, with only 14 of 36 hospitals even partially functional. Miscarriages are skyrocketing. Mothers who are too malnourished to breastfeed are using contaminated water to prepare baby formula. Once people facing such acute hunger approach death, specialized medical treatment is required to bring them, especially children, back to life. Half of Gaza's population is under 18. The alarm bells are blaring. The time to act is now. How to save lives. With safe and sustained access and renewed support for UNRWA, organizations like ours and our local Palestinian partners could quickly increase humanitarian aid. Add in a restoration of basic services like electricity and water, and a renewed flow of commercial commodities, and the picture could start to shift within weeks. But this crisis will soon reach a tipping point where emergency food aid won't be enough. Averting mass death becomes harder as starvation gains momentum. Food aid is urgent, but so too is providing medical care, therapeutic nutrition treatment, and adequate shelter, clean water, and protection for extremely vulnerable people. The enormous scale of humanitarian assistance and outreach this demands can't happen without a sustained stop to the fighting and bombardment and a dramatic increase in aid delivery to and within Gaza. Time is of the essence. The world can't let this window close. We need President Biden's word to translate into action. There are, quote, a lot of innocent people who are in trouble and dying, and it's got to stop. And again, the people that wrote this, Jan Egeland is Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Jada O'Doyen McKenna is CEO of Mercy Corps. Jeremy Kondike is President of Refugees International. Abby Maxman is President and CEO of Oxfam America. Michelle Nunn is President and CEO of CARE USA. Jonti Soripto is President and CEO of Save the Children U.S. Charles Awaba is CEO of Action Against Hunger. And Sean Callahan is President and CEO of Catholic Relief Services. Jeff?
Christian nationalism is more nuanced than you might think. This opinion piece by Daniel Darling, who is director of the Land Center for Cultural Engagement at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's author of several books, including The Dignity Revolution and Agents of Grace. Darling writes, ever since the tragic events of January 6, 2021, in which a handful of the violent rioters donned explicitly Christian symbols, much ink has been spilled about the rising threat of Christian nationalism, which critics charge is a malignant, anti-democratic force hell-bent on overthrowing American democracy. Fears of Christian nationalism have spawned a burgeoning subgenre of books, conferences, and journal articles. One widely cited survey, which included sloppily expansive definitions, found that 51% of Americans were Christian nationalists. And the new documentary, God and Country, which was recently released and produced by Hollywood mogul Rob Reiner, warns in ominous tones about the nationalists lurking around every corner. To be sure, there's an academic conversation among Christian scholars about the scope of government, and there is a small but growing cohort who are dissatisfied with classic liberalism and American democracy. Patrick Deneen, author of books such as Why Liberalism Failed and Regime Change, is part of a group of Catholic thinkers who espouse what is commonly referred to as Catholic integralism. Protestant author Stephen Wolfe has ignited a similar discussion in evangelical academic circles with his book, The Case for Christian Nationalism, in which he calls for a return to Christendom. As a Baptist, I strongly disagree with the theses of both Dineen and Wolfe. While Baptists advocate for a robust Christian engagement in the public square and believe that America's founding ideals are rooted, in part, in Christianity, we believe that the best social arrangement is a free church in a free state. I'm in full agreement with the critiques of Christian nationalism offered by such thinkers as Kevin DeYoung, Jonathan Lehman, and Kevin Vallier. How Christian nationalism isn't clearly defined and is overused. Still, the term itself has been employed to incorporate seemingly any Christian engagement in the public square. Even Michael Ware, former faith outreach coordinator for President Barack Obama, has shared his concerns about the way, quote, Christian nationalism is used in overly expansive way. Andrew Walker, a Baptist scholar, rightly pleads, convince me that your skepticism about Christian nationalism isn't just a cover for wanting Christians out of politics and out of power. Convince me that Christian nationalism is not just another progressive epithet hurled against conservative Christians. To address the lack of definition of what constitutes Christian nationalism, one group has released a survey that both dispels some of the hyperbole and gives a more nuanced picture. The group, Neighborly Faith, began with a 14-point definition of Christian nationalism. What the researchers found is that the number of actual Christian nationalists is much smaller than we've been led to believe. Only 5% of Americans self-identify as Christian nationals, and only 11% of Americans fit the category of adherents. Even among adherents, none hold to all 14 points of measurement, and only 31% agreed to more than 7. What's interesting is that even among Americans who fit the label, most display pro-democratic ideals. From the authors, quote, our study found that many of those we classify as Christian nationalists exhibit civic and pro-social attitudes and behaviors. They are among the most likely Americans to claim interest in working together with others on interfaith dialogues, 52%, providing food, medical supplies, or clothing to those in need, 77%, raising money or organize to help victims of a natural disaster, 81%, and discussing local issues and solutions, 65%. Over half, 51%, agree that the U.S. should take in refugees, even if I do not share all the same beliefs as them, nearly identical to the mood of the general public, about 54%. The survey also found that the conflation of conservative Christian Republicans with Christian nationalists is in error. While 60% of Christian nationalists are Republicans, 40% are either Democrats or Independents, and only 17% of Republicans are adherents to Christian nationalism. Patriotism isn't the same as Christian nationalism. Advocating for American public policy based on one's faith is not Christian nationalism. A robust love of country isn't Christian nationalism. Acknowledging America's profoundly Christian roots isn't Christian nationalism. And those who analyze politics and religion should be honest enough to admit this. That isn't to say there isn't a worrisome level of extremism in the country on both sides. The January 6th riots at the Capitol and the riots in protest of George Floyd's murder prove even a handful of extremists can cause major damage. In an election year that promises to be as divisive as ever, we should do everything we can to ratchet down the political rhetoric. One of the best ways to bring about unity is to diagnose problems as they are, not as we imagine them to be, and to avoid a broad brush in describing our fellow citizens. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And on to sports. We have things that are available to turn on your TV and watch or listen to. Starting with the American Hockey League at 1 p.m., NHLN, it's Rochester at Toronto. Auto Racing at 10 a.m. Oh, I guess that one's probably already, oh, might still be on. FS1 NASCAR Xfinity Series, the United Rentals 300 Daytona International Speedway at Daytona Beach, Florida. At 3 p.m. on Fox, NASCAR Cup Series, the Daytona 500 Daytona International Speedway at Daytona Beach, Florida. Men's Beach Soccer, FS2, 2024 FIFA World Cup Group Stage, Italy versus United Arab Emirates. Group A is Dubai, United Arab Emirates. At 10:50 today, FS2, 2024 FIFA World Cup Group Stage, Iran versus Tahiti. Group B is Dubai and United Arab Emirates. College baseball, 8 p.m. tonight. Pac-12N, UNLV at Stanford. Men's college basketball at 5 p.m. on CBSSN, Colgate at Lafayette. At 6 p.m., ESPN, Virginia at Virginia Tech. At 7 p.m., CBSSN, William & Mary at Charleston. And 8 p.m., ESPN, Iowa State at Houston. ESPN 2 at 8 p.m., Kansas State at Texas. ESPNU at 8 p.m., NC Central at Norfolk State. For women's college basketball at 11 a.m. today on Fox, Creighton at UConn. And let's see, also at 1 p.m. on Fox, Indiana at Illinois. At 6 p.m., ESPN2, Notre Dame at Duke, SECN at 6 o'clock, LSU at Texas A&M. Women's college gymnastics at 4:50 on ESPNU, Utah at UCLA. Horse racing at 2 p.m. on FS2, NYRA, America's Day at the Races. At 3:30 p.m., FS1, NYRA, America's Day at the Races. Men's lacrosse at 10:30. That was AM. I might catch part of it if you can, if you have this channel. ESPN2, PLL Championship Series, TBD, to be determined maybe, Championship, Springfield, Virginia. NHL Hockey, at noon, ESPN, Toronto at St. Louis. At 2:30 p.m., ESPN, Detroit at Seattle. At 6 p.m., NHLN, Ottawa at Tampa Bay. Men's Soccer at 2 p.m., USA, Premier League, Crystal Palace at Everton. And the final is for tennis at 5 p.m. tonight, Rio de Janeiro. Evidently, this is the station is called Tennis from what I make out here. Rio de Janeiro, ATP, Doha, ATP, Los Cabos, ATP, and Dubai, WTA early rounds. I hope you guys can figure that out because I don't know what the heck that means. Now I'll go back to Jeff.
The Drake women won their 20th victory of the season. Drake women's basketball team, who's now 20-5 and 13-1 in the conference, built a two-game lead in the Missouri Valley Conference with a 77-71 win versus Belmont on Saturday in Nashville, Tennessee. And the Drake men beat Murray State to improve to 13-3 in the conference. The Drake men's basketball team defeated Murray State 95-72 on Sunday in Des Moines, improving to 22-5 and 13-3 in the Missouri Valley Conference. It is time now for Dear Abby. We'll go back to Carol.
And headline says, girlfriend of 3 years learns horrible truth. Dear Abby, for nearly 3 years, I've been seeing a man who later asked me to move in with him. He abruptly stopped emailing me 4 months ago. I waited several weeks and then emailed him telling him how upset and hurt I was and asking what was going on. I found out, not from him, that he has been in a relationship with another woman for the past 5 years. I am furious. I'm at a loss about what I should do. Signed, Shattered in Oregon. Abby says, Dear Shattered, the man may have abruptly stopped communicating with you because the woman he has been involved with found out about you and the romance he was having with you. Have you heard from him since? If not, she may have rendered him speechless. It's important you find a way to discharge some of your righteous anger. Believe it or not, physical exercise can help. Talking to friends or a therapist may also lessen the urge to explode. Learn whatever lesson there is to learn from this and move on. Do not let it rule your life. Everyone makes mistakes, and he was one. Dear Abby, without consulting me, my husband gave my father's U.S. Army uniform to my brother, complete with honor patches. My sister-in-law now wears it as a fashion statement, saying she is a Sullivan. This is not sitting well with me. She's only a Sullivan by marriage. I feel it is disgraceful to prance around in something you haven't earned, and it's insulting not just to my late father, but to all who have served. Her father also served, but she's not wearing his uniform. Signed, Disrespected in the Midwest. And Abby says, Dear Disrespected, your husband should not have given your brother the uniform without first consulting you because it wasn't his property to give. What your sister-in-law is doing with it seems less like a fashion statement and more like an example of stolen valor, which may be offensive to many people, particularly to those who have served. It is not a crime by virtue of the fact that she is not impersonating a soldier, but it would be in better taste for her to wear her own father's uniform rather than your dad's. And now we'll go back to Jeff.
Well, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Monday, the 19th of February, 2024. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. Earlier, you heard from Nicole Tam and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to Iris programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.